These 2 days, or 3 days, we will be exploring a number of things, and I'm going to give you kind of a map, and then I'm going to ask for additional things that you might want to take another look at if we have time, but I can't promise everything. Today, starting today, we kind of do a mind map. This is module 5, and one of the themes will be integration. In other words, doing things to help integrate the learnings you've already had. So we're going to be alluding to some things, and what you'll be doing will build on some of the things you've already learned, so it'll be additive. And of course, so many things that you've learned are now very reasonably familiar to you, right? I mean, if you think about it, how many of you are noticing things you really never paid attention to before you ever took this class? I mean, you probably see things and hear things that just weren't part of your experience beforehand. You know, like if somebody's matching you or not, right? You may not have consciously paid attention to that in the past, but you might notice it now. Sometimes I'll notice I'm really in a great conversation and I'll go meta to what we're doing and I go, well, we're matching everything. No wonder we're in that kind of situation. So we'll be exploring integration, in other words, bringing more and more of the skills together. Plus there'll be some new things. And today we will explore in particular some submodality processes. One being fast phobia trauma process. This is one of the things that's helped make NLP famous because it works so reliably. And back in, before I learned NLP, as I mentioned last time, I studied psychotherapy and I was a psychotherapist by training. I remember reading in several places a number of people wrote that phobias are one of the things that are very difficult to ever work with. And in fact, they seem to be really almost related to psychoses because they're so intractable. And back then, the best treatment was, and still a well-known treatment, would be desensitization. So if you're afraid of spiders, they'd put spiders way far away in a bottle, and you'd look at it, and you kind of, when you could finally look at them from here and not be shaky, you'd go to here, and then, and when you got used to that, and then eventually after 2 years, the theory was you could get close enough to actually peer into the bottle. But most of you will find that by the end of today, you can take a fear or a strong emotion and kind of rewind it so it's not there anymore. And it's based on the way your brain codes information. So fast phobia, then I think what we'll add to it is trauma. One of the things I discovered was how to use it for physical trauma as well as just emotional things. So if you get hurt or you bump your head or you get in an accident, you can make a big difference with that. Also, pattern called the swish pattern. And the swish pattern is one of these universally useful ones. You can use it most in NLP. One of the ways of thinking about the techniques that have come out of doing NLP, which NLP is really the modeling process. Then the trail of techniques that came out of the modeling process or a lot of the things you've learned already. One of them is the swish. The swish can be used for conflicts, single kind of issues. Some issues are multiple outcome issues. I want that and I want that, right? So you're in a conflict, you're in a kind of a bind. And when Susie was here, she did a lot with that in December of how you work with conflicts and those kind of issues. Certain other things like anchor integration is you're anchoring a resource or a set of resources into a situation. So that would be a single outcome intervention. Swish will deal with either one. And it's really changing your experience of something. So if you see something scary, you quickly replace it with something that's resourceful. If you practice that a few times and do it quick enough, it'll start happening automatically. And it's one of the indications of just how well your brain can make change. Richard Bandler, one time, back when I was with him about 1983 or so, 85, said he thought the swish was the most important technique he'd come up with at that time. Keep in mind that's 1985. But it's kind of like, you know, my 85 Pontiac was like state of the art, but Now you go, wait a minute, Tesla, this Tesla is a little more advanced than that. Right? But the swish is still incredibly useful, and it's fresh. I mean, it's not like an old thing. It's just back then we didn't have certain belief change processes and things like we do in the wealthy mind that we've got now. So we'll be exploring submodalities today. And if we have time, either today or later this weekend, I want to kind of have a different category of things and to revisit anchoring. And in particular, how you might do covert anchors or anchors that aren't necessarily kinesthetic anchors, touch anchors. We're anchoring all the time. If you ever watched a really good speaker speak, and they'll talk about something and they'll say, you know, next year we're going to have this project and it'll all be in place. And so that's, what has he just done? And then later if he goes, blah, 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 and when we come back to this, and if you build this up, it becomes richer and richer and richer, and then you, pretty soon you can just, you know, you've got a full set of meanings here, and you've created a visual anchor. You also visually anchor with just a gesture, if you do it properly, with a tonality. Yes?
I notice good speakers will move at certain times when they speak. Is that anchoring as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I do it. I do it all the time. If you do it, one of the patterns in NLP is called quotes. I don't know if you got to it. If it was brought up. But it's one of the Milton patterns. It's the, you know, more the vague language, the artful language. But quotes is one of the patterns that you can use. And quotes is really good if you're not sure you have the credibility yourself yet. So let's say your group of senior managers, I'm the new person at work. If I want to say something, maybe I'll quote and say something like, you know, if Einstein were here, he'd say blah, blah, blah. Then I'll come back to here. Now Einstein's in that space. So if I come back, if I put this in quotes, it's going to be something. You might find that if you watch me, I've got all these things sort of systematic now. So... if you move, yeah.
Leadership really, really well, and he would do that. But I at that time, I didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah.
I knew he was moving and he was doing something.
Some really fine speakers will do it. I mean, they don't know NLP, but they know to get out of the space they're in. People will tend to anchor the space you're in. And anybody here from New York? Okay, good. I'll use that then. So let's say I was from New York, right? I came in and I said, well, you know, I know this is going to be a bit of a challenge because in New York we're way ahead of you people out west. Well, excuse me, I shouldn't have said that. I didn't mean that to come out that quite that way. Now, what I just do?
Separate
from, now what happens if I go back here? There's a jerk from New York again. But see, if I move out of the way, and it's part of the whole psychogeography thing that you hopefully learned from Susie, or
yes.
Yeah. So we'll be exploring anchoring and how you do it. And there's, you know, in a practitioner, of course, we can just give you the basic beginning part, and then you need to practice it. But when masters, it gets a lot deeper. But so anchoring, when you're presenting, you anchor. When you're talking, you're anchoring. You can't not anchor. You're always anchoring somehow. The idea is, can you do it intentionally and systematically to improve things? So this will be our goal for today. Tomorrow, we're going to enter a whole new domain of NLP that you haven't been exposed to yet. So tomorrow we'll get into metaprograms. And tomorrow Chris will join me and she'll be here for the last 2 days. Metaprograms are based on criteria and they're how you sort your experience of the world. It's kind of like your unconscious preferences. What motivates you? What's your working style? How do you operate best? And some of you are probably familiar with Myers-Briggs. Anybody know that one? Or the DISC model, which are, they're both really useful, very practical things. And Myers-Briggs is more like a personality test. And so you figure out, what's your personality? How do you go through life? Metaprograms aren't like that at all. Metaprograms are linguistic categories, or at least are preference categories that you can identify linguistically by talking to somebody. And they change by context. So you might have one set of metaprograms in one context, a very different set in another context. So they don't define you or put you in a box or say, this is your personality. They'll say, this is your preference in a situation. So, like on the job, what's important to you on the job, and then what are your metaprogram preferences? So these are things like, how many of you are big picture people? You're really good at looking at the concept. How many of you are detail people? You're really good at seeing the details and how it all fits together. So those are two different skill sets. Some people have both. But some people are, you know, the big picture people. They see the forest, but they miss the trees sometimes, right? Oh, I forgot about that detail. Then the devil's in the details, and I missed it. So that could be a problem. But often if you're a conceptual big picture person, you can be a visionary and stuff like that. If you're more detail-oriented, then you're going to be looking at those details and identifying how all those little details might be fitting together. So small chunk work, you know. And you find this, actually, metaprograms seem to be different in different cultures too. So that would be an example of a kind of metaprogram that you can obtain linguistically. So we're going to go through a number of these metaprograms, and if you learn them, they help you do anything more effectively, whether you're in sales or therapy or whatever. And by the end of tomorrow or the beginning of the next day, you'll have the basis for doing an interview that if you practice it 10 times, it's not hard to do and it's fun, you'll start hearing these in everyday conversation. You'll be able to go to a party and talk to somebody for 10 minutes and make incredibly precise predictions about how they're going to work in the world. When I worked with doctors, for example, some people are motivated towards what they want. They're goal-driven. Some of you in here are like that, right? You come up with a goal and you see what you want and you go, I really want that, and you go after it. Then other people might be more away from a problem. I want to keep away from that. That's not good. How many of you wear a seatbelt? Everybody, right? Why do you wear a seatbelt? Just call it out. Because I'm hearing two things. I heard safety. What's safety? Is that moving towards? Safety is moving towards what you want. I want to be safe and sound. What is avoid a ticket? That's away from a problem. Or I want to not get hurt. Now notice they may be saying the same thing, but the way the person's thinking about it can be really different. So you'll find that you can be motivated towards or away from, for example. So you'll find in better programs, you get a whole bunch of distinctions that you'll find really useful and powerful and interesting that you can apply to virtually everything you do. And plus, it'll start making certain things make a lot of sense to you. No wonder my boss is like that. It's not that he or she's a jerk. It's that they have a really different meta program than me. So you can learn to appreciate other people more. So that will be there. And then tomorrow one of the things we'll do is some integration activities that are fun, and I think you'll find really interesting, and will help build your skills. We will also explore the Walt Disney creativity strategy, which is a really nice way to learn how to be a lot more effective and creative at whatever you do. And once you've learned it, you can apply it to anything else, like health or well-being or whatever. I'm going to keep an open block and build in some things as in assessing what might be interesting or looking over what could have been left out or needs more clarification for you. So this will be our basic roadmap. And before we move on, what I'd like to do is ask, since our last weekend as a practitioner group, I know I've had talked to several people who said they're going to be at the Masters, so I think we'll carry on in a number of ways. But what, if you thought about, what's something you'd want another look at or a little more information about or another experience with, if you, knowing this is the last of the weekend? Which language patterns? Meta model? Meta model is okay. Meta model is one of my distinctions. For I think if somebody's, you know, when I talk to people, if they're a really effective NLPer, they usually have a good understanding of the meta model. So that's an important one. What else?
The work we did on the stimulus with the belief, the structure of the belief, and listening to the complete belief, that was
profound. So we have time, we could look at beliefs. By the way, with beliefs, the master practitioner is much more at that level the whole time. Because now you've got the basis to work ecologically with those bigger structures. So beliefs about identity, beliefs about the world, how you identify and change beliefs. It's there's a huge depth to it. And of course, we touched on it, and I think it takes some artistry to get down really good at it. Nancy, did you have? Yes?
I know this is just the practitioner, but a little bit on putting it all together. Like an example, is that what we're doing? Like if somebody comes to you and says this, like what might you reply to that? Like we've learned all these different things. We're going to do that there.
What do I do when?
Oh, thank you. Strategy. You already said that probably.
I didn't say it that way, but you said it in a very clear way. So yes, we'll be alluding to that the whole weekend. And maybe one of the things I could do is maybe do a whole piece of work so you can see how it looks when it all comes together. So, are there, yes?
In which situation do you use anchoring? In which situation do you use conflict?
Okay, what do you do? When do you do what? What do you do when? Perfect. These are the right questions because that's kind of that's the integration part. Yes?
I was wondering if we could do more work with conflict integration. Maybe
conflict integration. Yeah. Mo?
I have a question. So a lady came to me, she's having issues with anxiety. She's having panic attacks and whatnot in public.
Can you all hear?
No.
Could you actually, since you're in the corner there, if you could talk, stand up and talk loud in that way.
Okay. So, lady came to me, she was having panic attacks in like public places like banks and grocery stores, things of that nature. And I, kind of did some work with her, just asked her some questions and kind of got her back into that state, and then I kind of got to the root of the issue, which was she was diagnosed with diabetes, type 1 diabetes, like a few years ago or something like that, and she was having issues with control. She felt like she didn't have control of her life anymore.
Okay.
So did my own little process, and got her to feel like, I am in control.
So she got to a place where she thought, I do have control.
Exactly. So, asked her, you felt like you've been in control before, and then she's like, yeah, and then, took her through that, and then I acted that verbally, though. So I made her say it to her, something like, I'm in control. And so her husband, I trained her husband. Her husband came to me today and was like, she felt a panic attack coming on, right? And she just said to herself, I'm in control. And
good work.
And went away. So I was thinking, is there something else I could have done? Or more I could have done? Or
probably.
I guess that's my question.
Well, number one, your best answer is you said it already made a big difference.
Yeah.
Okay, so that would be, I'd say do this. That's your best answer. When I said probably, if somebody gets into a place where they're getting panic attacks, there could be a lot of triggers for that. So I think you've probably given her a good overall strategy for it. But one of the things you can always do to check it out is to say, what could still make you feel out of control? and then deal with that. So it would be finding a new present state, desired state. Because often people will come to here, but they still could go to there, if that makes sense. So, but it sounds like you already made a great intervention and a big difference. So, you know, so I get that question a lot. People say, I did this, and what exactly, like, one of the techniques I learned, it was sort of mixing a lot together, is that okay? And I go, what was the result? And they said, well, the person's a lot happier. And I go, well, that's your answer. And ultimately, in NLP, what we want to do is get to the point where you don't do any techniques anymore. NLP isn't about techniques at all. Techniques are a way to train it. They're an outcome that you get. But, you know, so the questions we have on what to do when are ultimately going to be, the answer is going to be, where's the person now? Where do they want to be? And what's going to take to get there? And we'll, and then that, then you figure out what kinds of things you do. But my goal and hope for all of you is that you'll start, and those of you that go into the master will be doing this pretty much, is figuring out what does it take to get the person from here to there. Because it's, and I don't know if I said this last time, but I've said it a million times, which is, in many fields, we have fixed procedures. It's our best option, like dentistry or medicine or engineering. So you follow a fixed procedure, and we have our best practices procedure. The problem is you get variable outcomes. But still, in those kind of fields, having a fixed procedure is the best idea, if that makes sense. If you're a doctor, would you want your doctor doing something different every time? Let's see, last time I took the appendix out this way. Roll over, let's try it from the back. And then it's probably not a good idea. So there are procedures that make a lot of sense in certain fields. With NLP, we want to get a fixed outcome and then vary our behavior, do whatever it takes to get there. And so, if you, because the problem with human behavior, if you follow a fixed procedure, you're just going to get two different outcomes. You can't predict it in the same way. So you have to go with the person. You're flowing with that individual. So, so yeah. Well.
I just wanted to add that the coolest thing about it was like, the coolest thing about it was that I just started taking her through the process. It was her and her husband. They were like, they didn't know
what you were doing.
What I was doing. Yeah, but I was aware of what I was doing, of course. And I just thought that was awesome.
Well, that's the way to do it. The way not to do it is to say, can I try this on you?
Yeah.
I'm in this class and I've learned this thing. Can I try it? And then confidence is going to get you in just doing it. It's going to get you so much farther than anything else. When I was first learning hypnosis, one of the things I got really clear about was that if you went in it confidently, somebody is much more likely to have a hypnotic experience than if you go, can I try this? And I think what I'm going to do is going to work. And so often I've had people come to me and say, you know, somebody did that with me and they almost did something that seemed really similar, but it didn't work. What's the difference? And I thought, it's probably because I believed it was going to work, you know, that you were going to make it happen. And so if you go in and go, oh, do you want to change that? Then people are more apt to.
So you're saying maybe it's not a good idea to, like, explain the different steps. Oh, because I was trying to take a coworker through the dynamic spin process, and she just couldn't, like, see it in front of her, and she couldn't really, like, see it spinning her. And we didn't have a lot of time to do it, but I was like, oh, I thought it was my fault. Well, maybe I didn't set her up for success. Maybe I should have, like, explained, okay, first we're going to do this, and then this, just so she knows what to expect. But you're saying no.
No, I wouldn't do that, usually.
Okay.
But for some people, it might help if you explain some of it. The problem for a lot of people is it can seem really kind of weird and simple. That's why we like to show the video first, because once people have seen the video and the kind of changes people can get, then it's more, they're more open to it. But if you just take a naive person through some of the things we do in NLP, you all remember the conflict integration?
Yeah.
One time we were doing a training in a hotel, and it was a big, vast kind of place. There was a restaurant up above it where people could look down in the lobby, and we had about 50 NLPers, and people were going like this, and people were looking like, these people are crazy, look at that, you know. So sometimes you have that. So I just give a confidence-building statement. like, well, it's based on, this is based on a lot of science and experience at this point. You know, it's,
so, and, you also
like, and just go through it. Let me take you through it, because it's a lot easier to experience it than for me to try to explain every bit of it. The problem is, if you try to explain things that people don't have a map for, they won't have any idea what you're talking about. It's like if I open a new topic I've found in training NLP, I need to tell a story or something so people have a place to hang it. If I just start giving information, I'll watch people waiting till they have enough of an inner experience to put things together with it. So, and you'll learn more moves for how to do things like that. So if I pull it out and I say, I can't see it, did you try, well, if you could see it, what would it look like? And things like that. If you, I mean, sometimes you just, or somebody has an idea, they have to see it like a Kodachrome photo or something. So get a sense of it over there. So it's, sometimes it's the words. You say, so if you sensed it over there, what would it look like then? First time I ever taught Circles of Excellence. Remember that from the first time? I was doing an intro. I wasn't even through my practitioner yet, but I had already been training a while. So I thought, we're going to teach Circle of Excellence because that's such a cool process and people can use that. I was doing a lot of health training. And so I had a group of about 30 or 40 people, and I said, who would like to be able to create a better state of excellence in a certain situation and be able to get it back predictably? So one guy came up, and he was really disassociated, and so I wasn't sure how it was going to work, but he came up, and so I said, okay, so we're going to create a circle of excellence. I did a little bit of explaining, gave him a couple of metaphors which might be helpful to you. So I said, I told him a story about Aldous Huxley. Do you all know who he was? He was a guy that wrote Brave New World and was a philosopher. He did all his writing in a particular chair in his office. And this chair was old and comfortable, and he had had it for years. And if he sat down in it, it was a really powerful anchor for his writing. He sat down and all this creative stuff would come up for him. And then his house burned down. And then with it, the chair. He actually had to go to Milton. He went and worked with Milton Erickson for almost a year to get his creativity back, because it was so anchored to that space and that. So the problem with Aldous, you know, his chair burned up. But if you have a mental circle of excellence, you've got it for the rest of your life, right? So, because it comes out of your imagination, which is one of the best things about us human beings. So I said, okay, so look down here and see a circle that would represent your circle of excellence. I always say, what color is it, to see, to make sure they're actually seeing something. The guy looked down, he said, I don't know, I can't make pictures.
Yeah.
And I thought, what do I do now? Because he was saying, I don't see anything, it's just the floor. I said, well, pretend you can see it. And he said, well, that doesn't make sense. And I said, well, if you could see it, what would it look like? And he said, well, if I could see it, it would be kind of an iridescent blue, like the reflective light in a swimming pool, and with a gold ring with colors emanating out of it. And I said, use that. You know, so sometimes if you just help the person with some kind of reference experience. So I just got lucky with that one, but it was I wasn't sure what I was going to do with somebody that didn't seem to be able to do anything I was asking. But I think sometimes you just experiment, Kara, with stuff like that. Okay, anything else you want to add to the list? I think the what to do when kind of question is probably important to most of you, right?
Yeah.